Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Greek economic crisis and speak with Richard Parker, an economic advisor to the last Greek government of Papandreou and the current Greek government of Papademos. We will discuss the second EU-Greek rescue package that is close to agreement and whether or not we'll prevent further instability in the Eurozone where austerity measures have slowed growth. Then we'll get an analysis of why the Syrian capital, Damascus, has so far escaped the Syrian civil war that has raged in the countryside, with other cities such as Homs facing destruction. Bilal Saab, a visiting fellow in nonproliferation studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, joins us. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. Then finally, we'll examine the latest outrage in Mexico's war against drug cartels that has so far killed over 47,500 Mexicans. The author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, Joan Grillo, joins us. He is a correspondent for Reuters who is covering the drug war in Mexico, and we will discuss the prison riot in which 44 members of the Gulf Cartel were bludgeoned and stabbed to death in a massacre that was a cover for a breakout escape of 30 prisoners from the ultra-violent Zetas drug gang. I'm now joined by Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also a senior fellow in the Shorenstein Center, and his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was an economic advisor to the previous Papandreou government in Greece and is an advisor to the current Greek government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And apparently they've been meeting in Brussels late into the night. I'm not even sure that they're still meeting. It's got to be awfully late in Brussels at this point. But apparently they're close to an agreement. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that is my understanding. I mean, this happened in October when they went through a previous round of negotiations over the so-called 50% cut in the private sector initiative or private sector debt holdings of Greek bonds, and it happened in last July as well, too. This is a very serious set of issues for both sides, and necessarily this is going to go right down to the wire.
But apparently under the bailout terms, Greece is supposed to reduce its debt to 120% of GDP by 2020 from about 160% now. Apparently, in the haggling to and fro, they're down to about 126-129%. Is that that's what's happening right there?
That's what the current projected is, because they don't think they'll make the 120 right now, so they're allowing for some wiggle room up on the upside.
So what does that mean in terms of the bondholders taking a haircut? My understanding was originally they were prepared to take a 50% haircut. And what is required is something closer to a 90% haircut. And my understanding is that they're at about 70%. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, again, these are numbers that have room in them depending on how you're doing the calculations. And this has been one of the points of contention. I worked very closely with the prime minister and the financial team for the government of Greece on the October negotiations, which led to the original announcement of the so-called 50% haircut. And the banks were reluctant then to take a 50% haircut and came right back to the Greek negotiators with, well, what I'll call ingenious ways of trying to make up on the fine print what they seem to be giving up in the headlines. And, you know, that's an ongoing struggle, which is, the banks don't like to write off these size losses. The European governments are torn because they want the bank's capitalization, the bank's financial health to improve. And, you know, the more they have to give up on these, the more it impairs their financial asset base. And so the European governments have been at times torn about just how much they wanted their own banks to take as a write-down in reality.
So the latest round of austerity measures and spending cuts that the Greek government is apparently agreeing to, and this is in the face of a $14.5 billion euro repayment of Greek debt due on March the 20th. I believe that what they're talking about in Brussels is a total of 172 billion, isn't it? something like that.
Yeah, that's the number that's being talked about right now, yeah.
Right. So, but at this point, the Greek government, who's already gone through austerity measures, is now talking about taking $1 billion generic medicine, switching to generic medicines in their healthcare, cutting overtime pay for hospital doctors, saving money on military procurement, and reducing the number of deputy mayors than their staff.
So, right.
I mean,
right.
What about the basic questions that, you know, because this has somewhat been racialized between the North and the South, the notion that right. the Germans are the thrifty, hardworking people and the Greeks are lazy and they don't pay their taxes. What about the criticisms that have been coming from German bankers recently about lots of shadow pensions and the rich don't pay their taxes? Because I understand the Greek government did put out a name and shame list of all the famous Greek sportsmen and celebrities, et cetera, that weren't paying their taxes.
Right. Well, look, I mean, this is a complicated issue. On the one hand, I've worked closely with the Greek government over the last 2.5 years, and there are several fundamental points. The Greeks, as a people, pay taxes. About a third of GDP is paid in taxes every year. That's higher as a percentage of GDP than the Americans pay. And so the idea that they don't pay taxes is wrong. What they don't pay is as much in income tax, both corporate and individual income tax, as the U.S. or other European countries do on average. And it is absolutely correct that Greece needs to become better at collecting income taxes, and that there is a lot of evasion, and that there is a broken both auditing system and also a judicial system for collecting taxes once taxpayer fraud or taxpayer evasion, illegal evasion, has been identified. So the Germans are right in that sense. The rest of Europe is right in the sense that the Greek tax collection and tax enforcement system needs to be very strengthened. The fact is, though, that the Greek government has not disagreed with that at any point and is moving rapidly to try to identify those taxpayers who are not paying and also to start the collection process. To date, they've been better at identifying who needs to pay taxes than they have been to collect the taxes, because it requires a fundamental reform of the judicial system. One proposal is that a whole separate tax court system, separate from the main court system, much like we have in the United States, be set up. And they're moving toward that, but it's not in place yet, and it's taking time. And there is obviously a lot of political resistance from people who are supposed to pay taxes. It is an ongoing struggle.
Well, how different is it then from the United States? The wealthy people in this country don't pay taxes, and we recently learned from Mitt Romney that he pays 15%, and that may have been news to a lot of Americans that the wealthiest, the hedge fund managers, only pay 15%. So, what's the comparison there?
Well, I mean, I think the comparison is that there is a lot of tax evasion in a lot of these countries. There is a lot of legal tax evasion, if you will. I mean, Romney's an example. I mean, no one's saying that what he did was illegal. It just happens to smack of gross inequity that someone that wealthy could pay that low a tax rate. This is the old Buffett versus Buffett secretary argument. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that these kinds of legal forms of tax reduction should be removed. Greece is in a crisis that is different than the U.S.'s crisis, because the U.S. is still the world's largest economy and the dollar is still the world's reserve currency. And so the United States has a lot of ability to borrow in the open markets. In fact, as you know, when the Fed lowered interest rates and some of the credit agencies started to threaten and actually did lower the rating of federal bond or federal paper, money rushed into the United States rather than rush out, which would normally be the circumstance. But that has to do with America being America. Greece is not on the same scale. Greece's economy is about, you know, 1.5% of the U.S.'s economy, 2% of the U.S.'s economy. And when markets refuse to loan to Greece, Greece doesn't have the options that the United States does. Is this unfair? Absolutely, it's unfair, but this is the situation, and it's what makes the Greek problem so enormous in terms of the Greek government and the Greek people being able to solve it.
There's a strange sort of a bit of irony here, Richard, where the prime minister from a dozen European countries, including the United Kingdom, wrote a letter Monday to the EU president and the European Commission president as well, saying that they were worried that more austerity could exacerbate Greece's problems by putting a stranglehold on growth and therefore making it impossible for them to pay back these loans that they're now negotiating. That strikes me as a little ironic, given what Cameron has done to the United Kingdom. I mean, I noticed a piece by Paul Krugman today in the New York Times about this kind of religion of austerity that has substituted moralizing for analysis and fantasies for lessons of history.
Well, look, I mean, I'm with Professor Krugman on this one. I think that the Europeans are making a grotesque mistake in calling for more and more austerity. Greece is a small and fragile economy at this point, and it feels very broken in spirit. And the willingness of investors to invest or businesses to expand or consumers to spend at this point is non-existent. I mean, the economy keeps contracting. Now, part of the problem is that the European economy has contracted. It didn't grow the way it was expected to in 2011, and some of the projections that were assuming that Greece could move back to growth itself this coming year were dependent on Europe growing. As a consequence, one of the problems for Greece is not only the burden which this austerity program places on it, but also the fact that the wider European economy is not growing. A third of Greece's economy depends on shipping and tourism, and shipping is still at the bottom of the barrel. The standard measure of shipping health, the shipping industry's health, is something called the Dry Baltic Index, which measures the cost of renting or leasing freighters to move freight, and it's at about 10-12% of the level it was at just 4 years ago, and it has not started climbing back yet. And until it does, a major sector of the Greek economy is going to continue to exist on life support. The second is that tourism is a huge sector for Greece, and for 3 years it declined steadily, which was terribly damaging. Now, in terms of total tourists, last year, tourism was up, but of course, all the television images and the talk of rioting in Athens means that the tourism right now is asymmetrical. People are trying to fly wherever possible onto individual islands or anything that they can do to avoid actually going to Athens. Tourism in Athens is down again. Tourism in the outer islands is starting to rise. But again, overall, you need a dramatic increase in tourism and in shipping to get the economy moving again. The third factor is that Greek exports, while they have risen, need to rise even more dramatically in order to close what's called the current account balance, basically the gap between exports and imports. Greece is still importing substantially more than it's exporting, and this is putting pressure on the economy as well, too. So you have a situation in which the Greek economy, because of the larger economy of Europe, plus specific factors having to do with major sectors of the Greek economy, plus the austerity program, are making it impossible for Greece to foreseeably get back to healthy growth.
But what explains this, Richard Parker, that irresponsible lenders, the banks who made these bad loans, are not punished, and the irresponsible borrowers in terms of governments are punished in the sense that they get voted out, and the previous conservative government in Greece were the ones that made a lot of these irresponsible loans, and we know that Goldman Sachs helped them disguise their sovereign debt. So the people who actually get punished are the Greek people, and that seems to be a pattern, given that so much of what's happening in Greece and Ireland is really they're at the Great Depression levels in terms of economic pain, and Spain with 23% unemployment, 50% amongst the young. Britain's economy has had its longest slump since the 1930s. I know we did something similar here. We Main Street suffered in order for Wall Street to be revived and now flourish. But what explains that that kind of paradox or disconnect?
Well, I mean, I think it's the asymmetry of power in the United States and the fact that the distributing the pain but capturing the gain is much the way that these economies operate when crises like this arise. I don't think that that's a shocking claim, but it's one that really is not discussed openly in most of these economies or most of these countries. And in fact, you have people who are being elected on these platforms of austerity across Europe and in the United States. I mean, the Republicans made unprecedented gains in terms of the Congress in 2010, running on a program of more austerity, more austerity, more austerity. Cameron was elected on a program of austerity. You know, this may originate within a small and well-to-do class within each of these societies, but for complicated reasons, they seem to be able to find a significant portion of the total voting population willing to buy this story. And I think that's a difficult situation.
So it's the economic illiteracy of most people thinking that somehow the house, just as you're supposed to pay your household debts, that somehow the national debt is out of control, and not realizing that they've obviously don't know about Keynes and some of the basic facts of economics, and who's out there teaching them, you know.
Not enough people, apparently, because to judge from the results, the information is not getting through.
So what do you think the impact will be then on... I've never been able to understand why the Europeans haven't been able to get their hands around this crisis. It's dragged on for over 2 years. The longer it drags on, the more expensive the bailouts become. And, you know, many people have said that Obama's re-election fate may well be in Merkel's hands. Already we've got a recession in Europe. Do you think it's going to impact the elections here, given the extent to which the Obama administration are trying to feel good about recent economic good news, if that's what it is, here in the United States?
Well, I think it'll have an effect. I mean, again, I'm not a political scientist, but I mean, anyone looking at the way the Republican primaries are going, how at the same time has to say, what Merkel might take away from Obama, Rick Santorum may deliver. I mean, if Santorum or someone like him were to get the nomination, I think it's a fair to say bet to say that Obama would be reelected. There's the ancillary problem, however, of what the composition of Congress would look like, because obviously with a Republican House and still an ongoing possibility, even if Obama wins, that the Senate will pass to the Republicans, this means that we'll have gridlock in the United States, which will only complicate this problem of austerity in the West that we're facing right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Parker.
Ian, it's good to talk with you, as always. I wish I came with good news and simple answers.
Well, I'm sorry to say that this is the way the world is, and I guess there's no point in being Pollyannish about it.
No, I don't think we should. I think we need to face what we're facing and recognize it and struggle on.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Richard Parker. And Richard Parker teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was an economic advisor to the previous Papandreou government in Greece and is an advisor to the current Greek government. Τα χέρια την τύχη μου κρατώ.